KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Reporter Emily Schwing spent the last year crawling through attics, basements, and classrooms in rural public schools across Alaska. What she found was a serious public health and safety crisis that's impacting Alaska's Indigenous students.
There's no mechanism to condemn a building in Alaska, but in the tiny community of Sleetmute, that's exactly what an architect recommended for the public school back in 2021. Angela Hayden is the lead teacher.
The roof was leaking when I first started teaching here 17 years ago.
That leak has been left for nearly two decades. Today, the building is on the verge of collapse. There are bats living in a utility closet and black mold throughout the walls and ceilings. Superintendent Madeline Aguilar says kids can't thrive in these conditions.
They're not conducive for high expectations. They're not conducive for academic achievement. They're not conducive for athletic, achievement.
It's not just Sleetmute. Dozens of rural public schools in Alaska face similar problems, and the health risks are concerning. Long-term exposure to black mold can irritate lungs and cause chronic fatigue and neurological problems. Fungal spores from bat feces can also irritate lungs and cause blindness. Higher rates of health disparities among Alaska Natives have long been documented compared to the general population, and the majority of students in Alaska's rural public schools are Indigenous. Education Commissioner Dina Bishop acknowledges the public health concern, but says her agency isn't solely responsible.
And if something's happening in the school, it's most likely happening in other buildings in the community. So, it is a collective Alaskan issue. That we'd be happy to have a seat at the table to discuss.
Andrea John has three kids enrolled in Sleetmute, and she says she thinks it's easy for the state to forget communities like hers.
Those city people, they wouldn't let their kids go to school here. They're choosing to look the other way and stay to house us.
Emily Schwing reports for KYUK. Support for this reporting comes from ProPublica and the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. A candlelight vigil is planned for Thursday night in Mesa, Arizona for Emily Pike, a Native American teenager who disappeared in January. She was staying at a group home in the city. Police recently confirmed some of her remains were discovered on a remote highway last month. Multiple agencies are now involved in the investigation, the Arizona Republic reports. Her family and the San Carlos Apache tribe where she's from are asking for privacy. American grasslands were once a mecca for biodiversity, but federal data shows more than 60% of the ecosystem has vanished due to agriculture, development, and invasive species. New research shows how the Mountain West region could play a role in the conservation of one important and yappy grassland animal. The Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen reports.
If you drive along a grassland, you might not see much. Anna Davidson says that's until you come across a colony of prairie dogs.
And as soon as you do, the life of the prairie is there.
Davidson is a scientist at Colorado State University. She says prairie dogs' underground burrows provide habitat for creatures from insects to ferrets. Her research team wanted to know the best spots to focus on their conservation, so they mapped intact native grasslands. But they also wanted to know where to avoid human conflict.
Is there oil and gas occurring there? Are there wind farms? Are there roads?
They found the highest potential for conservation efforts in the western portion of the grassland ecosystem. That includes less developed parts of Montana and Wyoming down to Colorado and northern New Mexico. I'm Rachel Cohen.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Those observations were not available, and that is going to impact every single weather model run in the world.
National Weather Service job cuts in Alaska may already be impacting forecasts. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a migrant detention facility in Guantanamo Bay is run by an Alaska Native Corporation subsidiary accused of civil rights abuses.
And I think it's really important to not necessarily blame the Alaska Native shareholders for this, but the broader system of this immigration detention center and this private contracting system.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
Alaska's National Weather Service offices have not been spared from the Trump administration's efforts to slash the federal workforce. As Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, the already understaffed agency's workforce has been cut back significantly, and lawmakers are raising concerns.
According to a source affiliated with the Union for National Weather Service Employees, resignations and firings have resulted in the loss of at least 23 Weather Service employees across Alaska. The person requested anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly. Rick Toman, a climatologist who spent 30 years with the National Weather Service, says the job cuts are already impacting forecasts. Last month, officials with the agency announced they would indefinitely suspend weather balloon launches from Kotzebue. Toman says weather balloon stations in Nome and Bethel also saw outages in recent days, though they've since come back online.
That is going to impact every single weather model run in the world.
Toman says forecasting is a complex science, and the three-dimensional view of the atmosphere that weather balloons provide is unique.
That's the primary use of those upper air observations. So not just the weather models run in the U.S., weather models run in Canada, weather models run in Europe, weather models run in South Africa, because effectively, these are all global models.
Roughly 800 people were fired across the Weather Service's parent agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That's according to a report from the publication Axios last month. And that includes at least 10 of the nearly two dozen lost Weather Service employees in Alaska, according to the union source. Others resigned after receiving the so-called fork in the road email from the Office of Personnel Management, offering federal workers what amounts to a buyout. The source says the firings and resignations include meteorologists, IT and electronics staff, administrative assistants, and more. Altogether, the Weather Service Alaska region has lost 10% of its staff, according to data from the Office of Personnel Management. And taken together with positions that were already unfilled, it adds up to a roughly 30% vacancy rate across the state's Weather Service offices. And that has decimated morale, according to the union source. They say meteorologists don't just check their work at the door. It's not just their job, it's their passion, it's their hobby. And they say it's getting harder and harder for employees to focus on the mission while they're worried about getting an email that might give them an hour to collect their things and head out the door. Toman, the climatologist, says he expects the effects of the cutbacks to compound as time goes on.
You're going to have fewer people working more. It's going to be, you're going to have burnout. You're going to have stuff be missed.
And with fewer people maintaining the dozens of automated weather stations across the state, Toman says he expects data outages like the weather balloon stations in western Alaska to happen more often and last longer. Political leaders across the state are raising concerns about the Weather Service cutbacks. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski said in a statement that Alaskans from fishermen to firefighters lean heavily on accurate weather forecasts. She says the cuts will have real consequences for Alaskans. Independent State House Representative Elise Galvin of Anchorage, who's been tracking federal firings, says she's concerned about the impact on public safety, especially in light of a recent avalanche that killed three people in Girdwood.
We do not even appreciate how important these scientists are to us until some tragedy happens. Let's not get there.
Republican Congressman Nick Begich also expressed concern in a statement, but he said the staff reductions highlighted the need to leverage, quote, third-party data. A variety of companies offer private weather forecasting services, but Toman, the climatologist, says few companies are willing to take on the considerable cost of maintaining launch sites across the country and around the world.
I don't even know if it's possible, but if it would be possible, you would be paying an immense amount of money for that, just for what the Weather Service does now at a, you know, per capita, a minimal cost for the U.S. taxpayer.
He says the business model just doesn't make sense. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
As the Trump administration's immigration crackdown has ramped up, officials are sending some migrants to a detention facility in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, that's run by the subsidiary of an Alaska Native corporation. Much of what happens at Guantanamo, infamous for the alleged abuse of enemy combatants held at the U.S. Naval Base there, is shrouded in secrecy. But there are questions about how ACIMA Infrastructure Protection, a subsidiary of ACIMA, itself a subsidiary of NANA Regional Corporation, is treating migrants detained there. Investigative journalist Jose Olivares wrote about ACIMA recently for The Guardian. Olivares says those questions about ACIMA follow accusations of civil rights abuses and health and safety issues at the company's other detention facilities.
And the inspector general essentially found that at the Florida facility that is run by ACIMA, there were instances where guards used an inappropriate use of force on immigrant detainees who were held there. There's one example that is cited in the inspector general's report in which guards opened the slot to a solitary confinement door and pepper sprayed a man who was detained in there, even though, and this is from, you know, the words of the inspector general, even though this person did not pose a threat to himself or to anybody else. That facility, since Trump stepped into office, has had two deaths. Two separate migrants who were detained at this facility have died since Trump stepped into office. And if we look at the other facilities too around the country, the Port Isabel Detention Center in Texas, which is run by ACIMA, that facility has been criticized for just the horrendous conditions inside the solitary confinement unit. The conditions were so bad that the inspector general actually recommended that the entire building be condemned and torn down and built again because of the ceiling that was caving in, the conditions, the mold, everything that was just so terrible within this building. So there's been a lot of complaints about these different facilities that ACIMA runs throughout the U.S. As part of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, network.
And in terms of how big ACIMA itself is, how much money do they get from the federal government in a year?
ACIMA is massive, and I think the exact numbers are hard to find out because ACIMA is a subsidiary of the NANA Regional Corporation. And so because these Alaskan Native corporations are owned by, indigenous Native Alaskan shareholders, you know, we don't really know about what goes on behind the scenes, right? The shares cannot be traded and cannot be sold, so there's very little regulation from the federal government, including the Securities and Exchange Commission. And so NANA itself, it's really, really difficult to understand and grasp the sheer size and how much money that NANA and ACIMA are making. Now, last year, ACIMA did publicly announce that the company is worth $2 billion. And they have, you know, over 40 subsidiaries within the broader ACIMA company. And all of those subsidiaries are getting multi-million dollar contracts with the federal government.
Is there a higher proportion of Alaska Native corporations in this line of work, or is it just that Alaska Native corporations are into government contracting and that's what the contracts are for?
I think it's difficult to say what the proportion is between just general security contractors and other federal government contractors and how it compares to Alaskan Native corporations. But I think it's easier for a lot of these federal governments to go to Alaskan Native corporations and their, you know, dozens and dozens of subsidiaries, right? So because there are so many subsidiaries and because they are owned by Native Alaskan shareholders, they technically are classified and qualify to be determined to be small businesses, right? And small minority-owned businesses. And so they're able to very quickly get government, federal government contracts for this type of work that essentially just kind of doesn't necessarily force the government or these corporations to go through extensive contracting bids and negotiations that maybe other companies might. But yes, I mean, ACMA is not the only Alaska Native corporation that does these types of federal government contracting work. I've done a story, for example, the Bering Straits Corporation. They run, or they used to run at least, a detention center in El Paso, an immigration detention center in El Paso. But a lot of the other immigration jails, the majority of them are run by private corporations, including CoreCivic or Geo Group or other large private prison companies. So no, ACMA is not the only one that's doing this type of work, but it is significant to note how they're able to very quickly get these types of government contracts. And it is significant to note that they received the federal government contract to run the ICE facility at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base last year under the Biden administration.
Yeah. So, Jose, tell me if I'm oversimplifying this, but it seems like at one end of this, you've got a lucrative government contract and migrants that are being detained in Guantanamo and elsewhere. And at the other end of this are Alaska Native shareholders that in some way are benefiting from that, right?
I think so. I think it's okay to simplify that. And I think it kind of speaks to just the broader questions about this system, right? I mean, I think because ACMA has so many subsidiaries, I think the question that needs to be posed is, do the shareholders, do the Native Alaskan people who truly do own the Nana Regional Corporation, are they fully aware of the type of contracting work that the companies that they partly own are doing? I mean, are they aware of the rights abuses that these companies have been accused of? Do they have any certain oversight? And I think it's really important to not necessarily blame the shareholders or the Alaska Native shareholders for this, but the broader system of this immigration detention center and this private contracting system that opens a door for these types of actions to take place.
That was investigative journalist Jose Olivares, who wrote about how the subsidiary of an Alaska Native corporation is running a migrant detention facility in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Olivares got no response after multiple requests for comment from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Department of Homeland Security, ACMA, and multiple attorneys representing ACMA in a lawsuit and in contract disputes. You can find his full story at TheGuardian.com. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Iditarod leaders take a much-deserved break in Galena.
Quigley and Rivet are doing amazing up front. They led every little mile so far. And a lot of nice dogs in the team.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
The three heli skiers killed Tuesday in a massive avalanche near Girdwood all had Minnesota ties. Alaska State Troopers identified the men as 39-year-old David Linder from Florida, 39-year-old Charles Eppard from Montana, and 38-year-old Jeremy Leif from Minnesota. They were on a guided backcountry ski trip with friends, according to the Minnesota Star Tribune. Linder leaves behind a wife and three young sons. He co-owned several Minnesota radio stations with managing partner Matt Kettleson, who praised him in a prepared statement posted on the station's website.
I will remember Dave Linder as an amazing family man, one of the smartest people I've ever known, and someone who lived life to the fullest.
The Star Tribune said Leif was a Minneapolis resident, and Eppard had attended a college in St. Peter, Minnesota. Troopers said the men were skiing Tuesday afternoon with Girdwood-based Chugach Powder Guides. They were caught in a slide near the 20-mile river, and guides said their avalanche beacons indicated they were buried in 40 to 100 feet of snow. Troopers tried to reach the site yesterday but were stopped by poor weather. They were making an aerial assessment of the slide area today to determine whether recovery work could be done safely. The Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center forecasted high avalanche danger in the area today at elevations above 1,000 feet. Additional snow yesterday meant both natural and human-triggered avalanches were possible. The center advised against travel in avalanche terrain. British Columbia Premier David Eby said today that he intends to introduce legislation that would place tolls on commercial trucks traveling from the lower 48 to Alaska via his province. As the Alaska Beacon reports, Eby was speaking at the Legislative Assembly building in Victoria and said the move is one of several that he is taking in response to President Donald Trump's erratic Canadian tariff plans. Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy said he hopes British Columbia will reconsider. Earlier in the day, the Alaska Senate had been planning to vote on a resolution praising Alaska's relationship with Canada, but that was pulled from the floor for unspecified reasons. Trump has twice said he will impose a 25% tariff on commerce from Canada and Mexico, only to recant once and change his mind the second time. Today, he signed an order delaying the Canadian tariff for a month. Canada is pressing ahead with response measures. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced retaliatory tariffs on Wednesday, and the leaders of individual provinces have announced additional measures. Well, marine species like salmon and humpback whales might be becoming more frequent fixtures in the Arctic, especially as sea ice becomes less reliable from climate change. For residents in Alaska's most northern communities, it can mean changes to subsistence. And as the Alaska Desk's Aliona Nyden reports, the shifts in migration are also fascinating scientists.
Catching salmon in the North Slope village of Kaktovik was unheard of not too long ago. But as resident Robert Thompson says, some fishermen now see salmon more regularly. About 5 years ago, Thompson caught a dozen salmon, a small but noticeable number, he says.
Before it was unusual and people would talk about it, but somebody got a salmon, but now it's fairly common, but not like many, many, many.
Fishermen, hunters, and researchers gathered at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage back in January to discuss changing migration patterns of several fish species and marine animals. That includes humpbacks, who seem to be gaining new ground up north, bowheads expanding their diet, and salmon observed in the Arctic. One of the conference presenters was Elizabeth McClindley, a graduate student from Bethel who grew up fishing for salmon. For a year, Lindley and other researchers tracked temperatures in the Anaktuvik River, which runs through gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. They saw that water at the depth of salmon nests never got below freezing. They also estimated that salmon emerged around August, which is later than in other parts of the state, but the optimal time for the Arctic.
The temperature conditions, it seems like they are survivable, and it does seem like they would allow for development to occur with enough time for them to hatch and emerge into the stream.
The warming environment has also been affecting bowhead whales. The animals have been delaying their migration to the Bering Sea or even staying in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas for the winter. Marine ecologist Clarissa Teixeira says the makeup of the whales' baleen plates can offer a window into their diet and movements. Teixeira sampled baleen plates from 11 bowheads and looked at the ice conditions during the years they were harvested. She discovered that after 2016, when the ice conditions were extremely low, bowheads expanded their foraging habitats or fed on wider composition of prey. She shared her discovery during the conference.
And that's amazing because it shows how resilient these individuals are, right?
Less ice might also mean new territory for humpback whales. Oceanographer Kate Stafford says data from local whalers and aerial surveys points to more humpbacks visiting the Chukchi Sea in recent years. In Utqiagvik, humpbacks were sighted only twice before 2021 and 2 to 3 times in years after that. Then, last fall, researchers saw more than 25 whales feeding close together for 2 days in a row.
We came across what I would call humpback palooza.
Stafford says that young humpbacks usually follow the migration patterns they learn from their mothers. Since researchers observed multiple mother-calf pairs, the whales might return to the area. Utqiagvik whaler Michael Donovan says he did not witness the humpback palooza, but he has seen a few humpbacks during his fall hunts. He says that he and other whalers are worried that humpbacks might be competing for krill and copepods with bowheads, the staple subsistence resource in his community.
Well, definitely they're an invasive species. You know, they come in and eat the same food that our bowheads eat.
Donovan and other hunters say they're supportive of scientists collecting data on whales other than bowheads, which are growing their presence in warming waters in the Arctic. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to health care in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
A statewide coalition is taking shape to oppose a controversial mining project on the Seward Peninsula. The movement comes a year after Canadian mining company Panther Minerals announced plans to explore a uranium deposit near Elim. And as KNOM's Ben Townsend reports, the group is planning protests along this year's Iditarod Trail, including at the Elim checkpoint.
It's the night before the Iditarod ceremonial start, and Ryan Cotter is shuffling markers laid out on a giant table.
Does the panther like have like a color? Is it a black panther? Is it tan? Or
Cotter Googles Panther Minerals' logo and carefully recreates it on a large white poster. It's one of many being made across the state protesting the company's planned project. Last year, the mining company announced its plans to explore two properties about 30 miles north of Elim on the Seward Peninsula. The sites are known to contain uranium, although the exact deposit size and grade level are unknown. Permitting took much of last summer, and now, with state and federal exploration permits in hand, the company plans to begin work this year. A different company, Tri-X Minerals, also explored the property in the 2000s, but that project faced pushback too from residents fearful of impacts to their subsistence lifestyle and health. In 2007, the Elim Students Against Uranium group was formed. The group made large paper signs bearing phrases like "No uranium mining in Elim" and displayed them at the village's Iditarod checkpoint. But after uranium prices peaked and then plummeted that same year, interest in a mine faded away. When Panther Minerals took over the mining claims last year, Elim resident Emily Murray says she wasn't surprised.
Yeah, we kind of figured they'd be coming and morphing into another name. We did our protest resolution to stop it and gain support from all, you know, people from all over, like the Lower 48.
17 years later, several organizations are joining forces to protest the exploration activities, including again at this year's Iditarod. The protests are aimed at two companies, Panther Minerals and Graphite One. The latter is taking steps towards opening a graphite mine on the Seward Peninsula by the end of the decade. The company hopes its deposit will meet the demand for electric vehicle batteries and other clean energy initiatives. Jasmine Jemawak is with the nonprofit Alaska Community Action on Toxics in Anchorage and is one of the organizers of the protests. She grew up in Elim and says resource development projects like Panther Minerals and Graphite One are presented as green energy solutions.
But in the process, they're taking it out of our land and contaminating our land and contaminating our food. And so that's the concern that we have.
Jemawak plans to travel to Elim for another sign-making activity this week. When the Iditarod rolls into town next week, the group hopes to bring awareness to what they believe is an underreported issue.
That's why we're taking this moment on the global stage to be like, hey, protect the Norton Sound, no destructive mining. We are trying our best to protect our indigenous communities and people who will have to deal with the the fallout of this.
A group gathered in Anchorage for the ceremonial start, and a small contingent demonstrated at the Fairbanks restart too. A final protest is also planned for the Iditarod's finish in Nome. Panther Minerals did not respond to a request for comment on the planned protests. In Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
Iditarod Trail sled dog race teams are trickling into Galena, almost 400 miles into the competition. Many say they're worn out after slogging through miles of soft snow and are looking forward to a solid 24 hours of requisite R&R. The Alaska Desk's Shelby Herbert caught up with the Breathless Mushers today and has this story.
Veteran musher Ryan Reddington is dumping a sack of frozen beef chunks into a bucket for his dogs just after he pulls into the Galena checkpoint. But breakfast isn't ready yet. He has to lug the beef buckets up a hill to the musher's checkpoint, where he can water them down and make them soft and chewy for his team. Even as he struggles with the buckets, he says, so far, so good.
Quigley and Rivet are doing amazing up front. They led every little mile so far, and they're doing really good. A lot of nice dogs in the team.
Still, the 2023 Iditarod champion says it was a slog for a while. Mushers say the warm conditions and soft trail up until this point are making things drag on. But they're hoping for thicker snow coverage ahead. Many, but not all, are stopping in Galena to escape the heat of the day. Checkpoint volunteers here have been busy hazing a moose away from the trail and flagging the way ahead as best as they can. They never got a shipment of trail markers, likely lost in the chaos of the last-minute route changes. Galena wasn't supposed to be on the map this year, but was added just 2 weeks ahead of the race due to low snow on the normal route. But volunteers say the surviving trail flags from the recent Iron Dog snow machine race are helping them close the gap and keep mushers oriented. Inside the Mushers checkpoint, an Iditarod tradition is about to begin. Every year, the first musher to get into a designated checkpoint is treated to a feast of the Yukon. And checkpoint manager Tim Bedoni says it's not regular potluck fare, even though there's plenty of potluck fare happening around there too.
They're always kind of bizarre, surreal experiences in which this really high-end food is cooked by executive chefs, seasoned professionals on hot plates, on Coleman stoves, in microwaves, and yet they produce this amazing restaurant, high-end bistro quality cuisine, often at 3 a.m. at a checkpoint.
Veteran musher Paige Drobny got into town first, so she gets an honored spot at the table, right next to local leaders and elders, and they all get a special full-course dinner, served up by Chef Carlos Walker of Anchorage's South Restaurant and Coffee House.
Chocolate bourbon pot de creme with a chantilly cream and chocolate sea salt.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
Drobny got in at about 6 a.m. and was woken up from a quick nap on a FEMA cot behind a partition to join the adoring crowd on the other side of the room. So, interestingly, the big fancy meal is happening at about 10 a.m., long before the regular dinner hour.
I'm stuffed. Five courses of goodness, and super, super excited to be part of it.
Her favorite course? The braised beef cheek bourguignon with asparagus, rosemary mashed potatoes, sautéed mushrooms, and shallot leaves. She gives her leftover entree to fellow competitor Michelle Phillips and heads back off to sleep. Reporting in Galena, I'm Shelby Herbert.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Chris Clinton, Ilona Niden in Anchorage, Ben Townsend in Nome, and Shelby Herbert in Galena. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Love takes the tears and pain. I can feel. is kissing man like a long walk home when the music stops. Take a tip from me, took it to the park. When you're on your own, it's a long walk home. Well, if they follow you, don't look back, like Dylan in the movies, on your own. If they follow you, it's not your money that they're after, boy, it's you. Pure, easy listening, settle down on the pillow soft. When they've all gone home, you can concentrate on the ones you love. You can concentrate, hey, now they're gone. But if they follow you, don't look back, like Dylan in the movie, on your own. If they follow you, it's not your money that they're after, boy, it's you. If we all went back to another time, I will love you over. I will love you over. I will love you. If they follow you, don't look back, like Dylan in the movies, on your own.
much more bad. You try to blame me, I put the blame on you. You play the game, baby, I can play the game too. You say you want me back, it's a simple fact that trolling all my girls got my back like that. Yeah.
Closed for evening, and the streets